Right now on the Daily Debrief, actress Felicity Huffman is out of prison early after admitting guilt in a college admission scandal. Also, a hearing in the case of a missing Connecticut mother. Plus,
I now declare a mistrial.
A second sex crimes trial for NFL player Kellen Winslow II. His first ended partially this way.
It now appears to this court that this jury is hopelessly deadlocked.
The Daily Debrief brings you the day in court. It's Friday, October 25th.
Welcome, everybody. Actress Felicity Huffman is out of prison after serving 11 days of a 14-day sentence. Huffman pleaded guilty in a college admissions scandal and did her time in a federal prison near San Francisco. The prison says it's normal policy to release someone on a Friday whose sentence is set for release, for expiration, over a weekend. Huffman must also serve 250 hours of community service, but she did already pay a $30,000 court-imposed fine. Cases remain pending, however, against 11 other parents who have been charged in connection with the admission scandal. Here early tonight, our former federal prosecutor Gene Rossi, criminal defense attorney Eklund Mercy, and Michael Bryant. So, Eklund, I got to ask you, that math is not adding up to me. She serves 11 days out of a 14-day sentence. Then she's released today because the prison says she's set for release on Sunday. Well, wouldn't Sunday be 13 days, not 14? Why not release her Monday, or is my math all wrong?
She needs to go and film films. That's what she needs to do. She needs to film films. But to be real honest, if she was in custody, it probably would have taken her 3, 4, or 5 days to even get transferred and transported to federal custody. So, I mean, give her a break. It's 3 days. Oh, calm down.
I'm not complaining about it. I'm just trying to add and subtract. I was confused here. Gene Rossi, former federal prosecutor, got to ask you about this one. The U.S. attorney for the District of Massachusetts is supervising this case. He is on the record saying actress Lori Loughlin, whose case is still pending, should get a harsher sentence than Felicity Huffman. Do you agree?
Absolutely. And I worked with Andrew Lelling, the U.S. attorney for the District of Massachusetts. He is a tough hombre. He's very aggressive, but he is fair. And the difference between Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin is night and day. I think Felicity was 15K, a little crumb, basically, compared to everybody else. And what her daughter got out of it was extra time. Lori Loughlin is off the charts. I think it was at least $500,000. And here's the other thing. Felicity Huffman is showing a lot of contrition. It could be an Academy Award performance, but she is showing contrition. The antics of Lori Loughlin, her antics before and after a court proceedings, they don't suggest a person that thinks she did anything wrong. So I think what the prosecutors did in Boston, spot on.
I look at the facts in these as well and say the facts are different outcome. Michael Bryant, some people disagree with me. Some people are saying that, you know, look, this shouldn't have been prosecuted as harshly as it even was in the first place. I see parents being hit with new charges this week and university officials being hit with new charges this week. Maybe a chance to pull a couple of strong arm tactics, get one group to testify against the other. We've got different charges in play. They're conspiracy charges. What do you make of it?
Well, I'm still getting over Eklund showing some mercy because I've never seen that before. Yeah, I think, you know, when you don't play ball early with the feds, and Gene would, I'm sure, acknowledge this, then they're going to keep playing the game, moving the ball down the field to the point where, you know, they got you in a headlock. And even if they cave in to some degree, it'll be far more severe, and in my opinion should be, because the level of the offenses is far more severe for Lori Loughlin. And I think that's what we're going to see play out.
We will certainly monitor the rest of these cases as they move forward. A brief court hearing today for a Connecticut woman charged in connection with the disappearance of her then-boyfriend's estranged wife.
In Connecticut Superior Court, the wheels of justice are turning, but slowly in some opinions.
State of Connecticut versus Michelle Traconis.
Michelle Traconis appeared on charges. She tampered with evidence and hindered prosecution in the disappearance of Jennifer Doulos. Traconis was dating Fotis Doulos, the missing woman's husband, while he went through a rancorous divorce. After the judge said he met with the prosecutor and the defense privately in chambers, the following exchange.
Your Honor, we are in the process of reviewing and investigating the discovery that we've been provided And I would ask Your Honor for December 6th for the next day.
Agreeable to the state?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, ma'am. Continue to remain compliant with your GPS and other conditions of release, which you have been. I'm pleased about that. So if there be no further business, then we will take up these proceedings again on December 6th.
Outside court. Trakonis, her family, and her attorney were flanked by security. None said a word. One question hanging over the proceedings is whether Trakonis will flip and become a state's witness against Fotostoulos. If so, the silence may mean something. The rules of professional conduct generally prevent attorneys from discussing the possibility of a plea for fear that it would poison an eventual trial if the talks fall through. So for now, the hearings continue and Trakonis's not guilty plea stands.
New court documents are due Monday in an appeal filed by husband Fotostoulos over a gag order in his separate case. The state sought the gag order to prevent Fotostoulos from arguing that his estranged wife disappeared in order to spite him, and maybe that she even faked her own death. A judge agreed with the state, but attorneys for Fotostoulos say the defendant has a First Amendment right to defend himself in public against claims made by the state that he was involved in his estranged wife's disappearance. Our guests are back again to discuss this case. Michael Bryant, I'll start with you. What do you make of this gag order, the appeal? Should the defendant have a right to basically go out and say, the state is coming after me and I didn't do it and I'm going to be vocal that I didn't do it?
I think in a case like this, if you open up that floodgate for the defendant, then the prosecution's going to have to respond or chime in. If they don't, they're going to feel like they're at a disadvantage. So I think a gag rule, a gag order in a case like this, perfectly acceptable. It has to be followed. Everybody just needs to shut up.
Well, you know, look, the First Amendment is the First Amendment, Michael Bryan.
Oh, I've heard about that.
You've heard about that. We tend to exercise it around this table frequently. And the courts are increasingly negative towards these gag orders. So this can be really interesting to see how the Connecticut appeals courts rule on this matter. Gene Rossi, Eklund Mercy, got to ask about the tactics here. Gene, do you agree or disagree with my assessment that maybe this thing is sort of rolling slowly down through the process of hearing after hearing to kind of wait and see whether Trakonis may decide to turn state's witness here?
Yeah, absolutely. You're talking about Michelle Trakonis?
Yes.
And I predict this. The delay is going to hurt the boyfriend tremendously because I can just feel that Michelle Trakonis is on the verge of cooperating for one reason. She doesn't want to go to prison. And she would be a phenomenally helpful witness for the prosecution. So I think she, at the end of the day, is probably going to cooperate, plead guilty, and testify against her boyfriend.
You know, that's what I predict as well. And look, we're speculating. We're just trying to read into things here a little bit. Eklund Mercy, you're the criminal defense attorney here. Do you agree or disagree with my assessment on this? What do you make of it?
Yeah, I agree. I agree with Gene, and I agree with you. You can tell by her model walk down that sidewalk that she loves and values her freedom and that she will do whatever it takes to keep it. So I don't think it will take the state much to get her to turn state's evidence.
You know, Eklund, the body language is something that I've noticed too, because in some of the early hearings, and I've been present for these, okay, they're not far away from us here in Midtown Manhattan, so I've been up there. Originally, we've seen her break down crying. Today, I saw a lot more confidence than I've seen in some of the other hearings here. The judge said, I met with parties in chambers. Now we're on the record. Who knows what they discussed in those chambers? Big question. We can guess. We can speculate. We're going to keep watching that story as well. The survivor of the so-called Slender Man stabbing in Wisconsin is speaking publicly for the first time. Friends Morgan Geiser and Anissa Wire were charged after they stabbed a friend to allegedly appease the fictitious internet character Slender Man. Wire admitted involvement. A jury found her not guilty by mental disease or defect. She's serving a 25-to-life sentence. Geiser accepted a plea deal, was found not guilty by mental disease or defect, and is serving a 40-to-life sentence. That's how it rolls under Wisconsin law. I realize it's a bit confusing. ABC News' David Muir spoke to the survivor for the first time. Here is a preview.
And this is the first time that Peyton Leitner is talking. Do you remember leaving the park to go to the woods?
This is the most unbelievable story I've ever heard. Who the heck is Slender Man?
Three 12-year-old girls had a sleepover.
The suspects lured the victim into the woods, and all three of the girls are 12 years old.
What did she do next? Stab.
If she saw this interview, what would you want to say to her?
We'll have to wait and see. The full interview tonight at 9 Eastern on the ABC network. And still ahead tonight, a hearing in the case of a real estate mogul suspected of killing a woman who knew he killed his wife. Plus, a retrial starts this coming week for the NFL player whose original trial resulted in a partial acquittal, a partial conviction, and a hung jury on many counts. Our look ahead is after the break. A hearing is set for Monday in the case of a millionaire real estate mogul facing a California murder charge. Robert Durst is accused of killing his friend Susan Berman 2 decades ago. The state will be able to admit several comments Durst made to a friend and to filmmakers about Berman's death and also about the death of his own wife back further in 1982. Prosecutors told a judge early last month that they believe Durst killed Berman because she had evidence that Durst had killed his wife.
I've been doing this job not as long as Mr. Ray, but 25 years. Done a lot of homicide trials, a lot of preliminary hearings, seen a lot of them, etc. I believe that the amount of evidence put on at this preliminary hearing is probably more evidence that's been put on in any murder case that I can remember happening in Los Angeles County, admissible evidence. So the idea that somehow there was faulty evidence, inadmissible evidence, a lack of evidence, just doesn't work. We have litigated these motions over and over again. We've litigated 1390 four different times. This is a classic 1390 case. The court made the findings after having a detailed hearing, detailed arguments on three different occasions. It was properly admitted. Susan Berman was killed because she was a witness, because she helped Mr. Durst originally cover up the death of his wife, Kathy. She has stated that to numerous individuals. Mr. Ray gets up here and he says, well, Judge, I'd like you to assess the credibility of that evidence. The court very quickly responds, wait, Mr. Ray, is that my job? The court knows it isn't. I think Mr. Ray, he's in a tough position. There's not a whole lot for him to argue. But even if we wanted to somehow look at the credibility of these witnesses, we have somewhere in the area of 10 different witnesses coming in here and saying similar things about statements Susan made under forfeiture by wrongdoing. The court's ruled. It was properly admitted evidence, and it's a classic witness killing case.
The state's assessment is that Durst is guilty, of course, that's why they're trying him, and that Durst's own words are helping the state prove it.
Mr. Durst himself has confessed to this crime on, I believe, 2 different occasions, at a minimum, 3 arguably. You can't get stronger circumstantial evidence than when you have somebody who's being accused of committing a murder. And instead of saying, I didn't do that, I can't tell you anything, how would you expect me to give that information? The one of the response is in essence, well, I don't know if I want to talk about that part, or I don't really want to go through that. Your Honor, that's an admission any way you shape it. Susan Berman was executed from behind at close range. That's the physical evidence that we have. They make a movie. The movie was sold, marketed, advertised as the story of Bob Durst. He goes and he watches the movie. And this is compelling. The one thing that bothers him, is it any of the violence against Kathy? Is it when he is depicted as having killed her? Is it as depicted as when he plans and has his cohort allegedly murders Susan Berman? Is it when he murders and dismembers the Morris Black character in the movie? Oh, none of those give a peep from him. Not one, hey, that's not accurate, that's not right, that's not correct. But when the scene comes up of him allegedly killing his dog, he's not asked. He says, Andrew, that I do not like.
In the final scene of the HBO series The Jinx, Durst makes his so-called bathroom confession. There he says he killed them all, of course, not knowing he was still being recorded. Durst's attorney says it's no coincidence Durst was arrested after that scene. The defense has argued that the state was colluding with the TV producers.
It's very illustrative of what Hit the Ground Running was trying to do. They didn't bother to tell the people, hey, we turned the order around here so it sounds a lot more damning than it actually was. They leave in that very misleading, tampered evidence. Why? They wanted to charge Mr. Durst. And they wanted to charge Mr. Durst as soon as possible. And to allow Hit the Ground Running to pick and choose or to cherry pick what they're going to disclose, what they're going to talk about, when they're going to talk about it, and how much they're going to say is fundamentally unfair. They made the choice to collaborate with law enforcement. That choice can be as honorable as the day is long, but it has consequences. And the consequence is, once they became an agent of the people, they forfeited their right to decide what they're going to hold back under their shield or not.
Of course, talking about journalist shield law there, the judge last month ruled that Durst's statements to the makers of the movie All Good Things, Durst's statements to the HBO film crew, and Durst's statements to both prosecutors and his own friend were all good evidence.
Well, that is strong circumstantial evidence that Mr. Durst was involved in, if not the killer of his wife. There has to be a belief by Mr. Durst that there was a witness to a crime. Now, that witness was Ms. Berman. The crime was the killing, disappearance of his wife. What's relevant is Mr. Durst's state of mind. He believed she was a witness, and that's what witness killing is. It's a state of mind special circumstance. That is more than slight evidence. That is sufficient to establish that Mr. Durst is responsible for the homicide.
We will be watching that hearing next week, and Law and Crime will also be covering the retrial of a former NFL player accused of sex crimes. Kellen Winslow II faced one trial earlier this year, which ended with a mix of convictions, acquittals, and a hung jury. Prosecutors are retrying Winslow next week on the charges upon which the original jury was hung. Here is a look back.
We, the jury, find the defendant guilty of rape by force or fear.
Count 4 involves Jane Doe number 2. The jury convicted Winslow of raping the woman who described herself as homeless.
They had me take my pants off, and pulled me on front of the seat, and, you know, started to rape me.
During testimony, she refused to look at the defendant.
I really don't want to look at him, sir. I don't appreciate it.
Appreciate what?
That I have to look at my rapist.
However, the jury refused to agree on a special allegation that Winslow raped more than one woman.
Count 6. Guilty.
Count 6 involves Jane Doe number 3. Here, the jury convicted Winslow of exposing himself to the woman who was gardening at her home not far from Winslow's.
Count 9. Guilty.
Count 9 involves Jane Doe number 5. Here, the jury convicted Winslow of lewd conduct at a fitness center weight room.
Pointed his penis. He said, "Do you see this? Do you like it?"
But the jury acquitted Winslow of another instance of alleged lewd conduct in a gym jacuzzi.
He was masturbating.
The jury deadlocked as to the remaining counts involving Jane Doe number 5, cruelty to an elder, and battery against an elder. The jury also deadlocked as to all counts involving Doe number 4, who said Winslow raped her 2 weeks after consensual sex back in 2003, when she was 17 and he was 19.
The jury was completely hung as to the accusations levied by the first accuser, the so-called Jane Doe number 1. Here's her testimony in the original case.
When he inserted his penis, it hurt so bad.
That is the voice, and these are the hands of Jane Doe number 1.
Yes, I kept on saying, ow, 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 because I don't know how he fit that thing in there.
The 54-year-old woman testified that she was a transient and was hitchhiking when a man approached her in his vehicle on March 17th, 2018.
And then all of a sudden he goes, "I'm not going to take you to Vulcan, I'm going to take you to the store and f*** you."
She went to the police 4 days later despite threats.
He's like, "No, no way, I'll kill you."
The defense reminded her that she previously identified one of the attorneys, rather than the defendant, as her attacker.
"That's still the person who raped you?"
"No, it's the one next to you, him."
"Yeah. Prelim, you were pretty sure about it."
"Okay, right? Just a moment."
She also failed to accurately describe the suspect's vehicle.
Michael, Jean, and Eklund are back one final time tonight. We have a chart showing all of the counts upon which the original jury was split and couldn't come to a unanimous decision. So this breaks it down. That's a lot of uncertainty, and we have the vote tallies. The jury was leaning towards guilt, but a lot of people saying not guilty on a lot of these charges, so they have to retry him all the way up and down there with accusations involving four of the original Jane Does. Eklund, Mercy, your analysis of this case.
I, believe it or not, it's too much. I actually believed Jane Doe number one, because if you work with transient people, if you work with homeless people, she was being as honest as she can possibly be. So her testimony, if you're in that world, if you have been a public defender, or if you have helped homeless people, like, you understand that that's her, like, that's her testifying. But with regards to everything else, you can see the reasonable doubt by the numbers. To try the ones that are 7 and 5, 7 and 5, it's just not the best way to use your money. It's not the best way for judicial economy. I wouldn't do it.
Gene Rossi, former prosecutor, would you push forward on this the same way you did in the first trial?
No, as I said many times on this show, I always retried a case if it was 11 to 1 for guilt, 10 to 2, 9 to 3. When it got down to 8-4 or 7-5, I said, forget about it. And I think the only reason they're doing this, in my humble view, is they want to ensure that evidence comes in at trial, because it goes back to what Mr. Carlos said in the closing. You know, you got five women. Now it's down to four. But if you continually say four or five, where there's smoke, there's fire, and a jury's going to say, we have to find them guilty of something.
Michael Bryant, I'll give you the final word on this as we wrap up here. Is it fair to just pile all the accusations on together and say, well, they must be true because everybody's accusing him?
Yeah, that's a California thing. Everything comes in. I think the prosecutor wants a rape conviction, period, because combining that with the first one means life in prison.
Exactly. We're going to wrap up for the debrief tonight. Thanks a lot to the panelists who joined us. Thanks to those of you who've been watching this week. We will be back on Monday here on the debrief at 5 o'clock. Live trial coverage resumes at 9 a.m. Eastern on Monday.